Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. It is December 26, 2009, and this is the last show of the season. And in the second half today, I'll make an effort to do some summary of what's gone on the show through the last year. Like to wish everybody Merry Christmas or a holiday season if you're not Christian, and wish people a Happy New Year, and I hope we're going to have a year of change and dramatic change, but I will talk about that a little bit more at a later point about the prospects for the new year. My website is at www.zeropoint.ca, and I have chapters from all of the books that I've written are up on site, as well as a wide variety of other articles and interviews and videos. There's valuable video of my presentation on Blavatsky's work in California 2 years ago. I watched that the other day and was really quite pleased with it. Sometimes it's often very hard to hear yourself or watch yourself. It is for me. Anyway, please visit my website. And I'm very pleased to announce that I think early in the new year I will have copies of The Heart Doctrine in trade paperback format. They're going to be published 6x9-inch trade paperback format, and they'll be available through Amazon or any bookstore throughout the States and I think Canada. And I hope that's going to be produced in January. And in February, I hope that I'll have God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine ready for publication, also in a trade paperback format. So it's been, for me, a long time. I've worked on my books for 30 years, and I print them myself and put them in Sirlock bindings and sell a smaller number of books. But I hope this will make my books available to a much broader market, and also at a better cost. And I'm very excited about producing the new version of The Heart Doctrine. And I've been honored by Rasuli, an amazing American artist who's agreed to allow me to use his image called Veiling of the Soul as the illustration on the published edition of The Heart Doctrine. And if you go to my website, you'll see the image, and it has six angels around a heart and a central figure in the heart. So in a way, it depicts the mystical Heart Doctrine. And that's what the book is about, called The Heart Doctrine, Mystical Views of the Origin and Nature of Human Consciousness. So I'm very excited about that, and hope that the year 2010 is going to be an important year for my own work. As some listeners may know, I had my house burned down last July, and I lost my book collection. It is the worst loss for me, thank goodness. No one was hurt, and I had only minor injuries. And I managed to escape with my computer, so I didn't lose my writing, which would have been a pretty major blow for me, and I rescued some family pictures, so I've gotten through that fairly well. And at the moment, I've been put up in Ottawa, Ontario, by the insurance company until I can find a new place, and now I'm likely to rent a house in Kempville, Ontario, and move the Zero Point Institute there. And it's a nice big older house, and it's on the river, once again, and it's more downtown Kempville, so I'll try to once more establish the Zero Point Institute and run it out of Kempville, Ontario. So that, I take possession as of February 1st, so that'll be a new chapter in, I hope, what is the evolution of Zero Point Institute. I use the term Zero Point, which is an occult term, drawn from The Secret Doctrine of Madame Blavatsky, which is a book published in 1888 and regarded as one of the classical books of Western occultism. And The Secret Doctrine is a remarkable two-volume set. Each is about 700 pages long, and the first deals with cosmogenesis, or the creation and evolution of the universe. And book two deals with anthropogenesis, which is the creation and evolution of humankind through all different races and root races and such. So my writing on Blavatsky is based on volume one, The Cosmogenesis, and I explain the relationship of Blavatsky's ideas in 1888 to the newest ideas in modern science and cosmology and physics. So I'm very pleased. I've just done a re-edit of that book and getting it prepared for this February publication. So I hope 2010 is going to be an important year for Zero Point, and I hope again to promote my work more actively publicly and seek other radio and interview opportunities, which I hope will come up as my books are published. Okay, so it's holiday season. We'll talk about that in a moment. I'll bring my co-host on. I'm in Ottawa, Ontario, and my co-host is James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario. And Jim and I have been friends for 40 years, I must say, a long time since going back to high school. And we've shared interest in occult science and regular science, not just occult science. We're interested in psychical phenomena and the nature of reality. And we've investigated these through our lifelong pursuit. It's been a lifelong pursuit for us to investigate these issues of consciousness and occultism and science and so on. So welcome, Jim. Thanks for making it out today for our show.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Good to be with you.
You got some freezing rain in Toronto there?
We don't have it here, but I guess all through eastern Ontario, there are warnings, and that's why I'm not in Ottawa for visiting my relatives. And
We have it now here. It's been raining quite hard.
Yeah, the storm came up from the States and didn't look pretty. So it's just very mild here actually in Toronto. So we have not a non-white Christmas. I think we've only had one snowfall this year. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's gone. Yeah. It's very green here. It looks like October outside. It's just looked out the window.
Wow, really? I didn't realize that.
They
had more major storms in Midwest states, I guess. They had major storms, and then I think on the East Coast as well, eh?
Yeah, pretty much everywhere except, I think, Central Ontario in Canada has had major snowfalls. But yeah, it's been weird this year, actually. But it seems that this is part of a pattern here in the Toronto area, is that winter doesn't start until January now, and then it seems to linger a little longer. Definitely something's happened in terms of the seasons. They seem to have shifted a bit. So
yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So glad to be able to participate today, because I didn't think I was going to be around. So yeah. So that's good news about the heart doctrine. So you'll be. You're putting it into a PDF format, and then it's printed on demand. Is that how it works?
Yeah. It's through a company in the States, and they print them on demand, and enables me to maintain copyright of the materials.
Yeah.
And I make a much higher proportion per book than I would if I went through a regular stream. Even though it doesn't have the advantages of the promotion and distribution that other books.
That's the big part, is the hard. But, I was actually thinking I'm going to try a couple more conventional publishers in the new year with an alien intelligence, and then if I don't get anybody interested, I'm going to publish it myself, because I'd like to have my book out there and available.
Yeah.
So
I was hoping to persuade you to do that.
Yeah,
I'm definitely
going to
talk to you about that.
I'm definitely going to do it, because I was talking to... And I've been corresponding with an old friend many, many years ago that I've sort of reconnected with, who has an interest in. I sent him the beginning of an alien intelligence, and he was very enthusiastic about it. And I realized that there's one thing I wanted to sort of go back and add to the material. There's a book out on Uspensky by a guy named Gary Latchman that came out about 2 years ago, and I want to have a little bit of material on that, because I think it's an interesting book, but I think he really misrepresents the relationship between Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and I don't really like what he argues.
Yeah, you don't mention who your friend is, you're speaking of Jonathan Cott.
I
was thinking you've had a long correspondence.
Jonathan read the book a few years ago and really liked it. I don't even know if you remember Fergus McDowell, who went to high school with us at Marivault.
Yeah,
he and I were friends in public school, of all things, and there was an article about a month ago in the Ottawa newspaper where a guy had bought the Merivale High School band album at a yard sale or something, and wondered where the band members were, and then it was through a series of things in the paper that my brother drew my attention to in Ottawa. Fergus's email showed up there, and I mentioned to this guy, the guy who wrote the article, that I often wondered what happened to him, because I knew he was interested in philosophical issues and the sort of the meaning of it all. And, you know, I hadn't seen him since the end of high school. I saw him in 1968, but haven't seen him since, you know. And so we reconnected, and he has an interest in the fourth way and various philosophical issues. He's retired, lives in the Ottawa area, so we've been corresponding.
Nice.
And I sent him part of my book on alien intelligence. He was very, very interested. He's also a musician, so he's very interested in the Gurdjieff music. So I told him about the Keith Jarrett recording of the Sacred Hymns, which he was very interested in. So, yeah.
You know, just to stay on music for a moment, like, and you mentioned Gurdjieff's in the Gurdjieff work, he has two what he calls fundamental cosmic laws, the law of three and the law of seven, or the law of the octave.
Right.
And what astonishes me is that in Beelzebub's Tales, Gurdjieff, I think at one point, says that the ancients encoded these laws or principles into the design of the musical octave and into the keyboards.
Right.
And it's interesting that if a person takes a regular full keyboard, you find that keyboard has seven octaves in it. And this is exactly similar to how esotericists describe the structure of existence. They say there are seven planes of existence, and each of these seven has seven subplanes. So in the Tibetan Buddhism, for example, it said there are 49 planes of existence. And in a way, that's on the piano keyboard, you have 49 keys of seven octaves, and then the final do, which is, we might even think of nirvana, the 50th state beyond the 49 planes of existence. And then, so in a way, you have that notion of the seven by seven fold nature of things in the piano keyboard. And then you also, in the piano keyboard, have other mysteries of what Gurdjieff calls the law of the octave, as pertains to how in an octave you have certain points where there are what he calls missing semitones. So in an ascending octave, you would go do, semitone, re, semitone, mi, but between mi and fa there's no semitone. And on a piano, that's where you have no black key, there's no half note. So that's one place, there's a missing semitone. So then you get to fa, sol, la, si, and then between si and the next do, once again you have a missing semitone. So those are two places in the octave that Gurdjieff explains there are these missing semitones. And this is a very profound idea that is it's complex to apply it to science and physics, this idea of the missing semitone, but it has wide application. And it's all there write on a piano keyboard is these kind of mysteries of the law of seven and the law of the octave, and it's all embodied there on the piano keyboard, which is really quite astonishing, don't you think, Jim? It's so simple in a way.
Yeah, like, well, yeah, but as you say, it's practically it's very difficult to apply it and to understand it. Like when Gurdjieff had a very brief period when he composed music with the aid of a classically trained Russian composer, Thomas de Hartmann, and de Hartmann had been a contemporary and I think perhaps a student of Tchaikovsky's and had studied in Russian Musical Conservatory and was highly trained classical composer, and said he learned more in that year and a half about music from Gurdjieff than he had in all the time that he'd been in the conservatory, because he said Gurdjieff, the thing was talking about in composing music, he said that it had to do with the structure of the music he was composing had to do with the tension of inner octaves within different pieces that he was composing, and certain tensions and releases within the octave. And I mean, I don't even know what that means, but I know that the music that he composed is very peculiar. It's, I mean, it's based on sacred Eastern music, which he had studied at various places, but it is original in a sense, but it's also based on very ancient teachings.
It certainly is a beautiful album, the Keith Jarrett edition of the Gurdjieff Sacred Hymns. They're such beautiful, moving pieces. They have fairly slow tempo to them, very emotionally centered in bills and climaxes. Very moving music.
Very, very interesting music. Again, like this whole idea, like you say, I mean, even the idea of the octave, you know, the law of the octave is formulated by Gurdjieff when he first explained it in his meetings in Russia, in the pre-revolutionary Russia. He was talking in there about the discontinuity of vibrations in an octave, and he said that modern science recognized the continuity of vibrations and that things proceeded unless there was some sort of resistance which slowed or retarded the progression of vibrations. But he said that nature consisted of structures in which there was an inherent discontinuity of vibrations. And in a way, I read this piece by this guy who's a physicist, and he suggested that really Gurdjieff was describing was that things are quantized before Planck had even said that things were quantized, you know, and that the idea of quanta is in the idea of the octave structure.
That implies the fact that there are quanta, there aren't particles that have any artificially arbitrary amount of energy. Instead, energy packages are quantized at discrete levels of vibratory creation. Yeah, and they don't assume values in between. Yeah, it's an amazing, the law of seven and the law of the octave. I've always felt the most important example and application of that is to trying to understand the evolution of humankind as a species. And Gurdjieff explains that there are really seven levels of human beings. And he says that most people are a man number one, a man number two, or a man number three. So either a do, re, or mi of the cosmic octave. And their type depends upon what function is most dominant in them, whether they're mainly a physical, sensory type of individual, or an emotionally centered person, or an intellectually centered. But he explains that very few people fully develop mentally, emotionally, and physically, and so transform to get to the level of the first level of awakening, which he calls a man number four. So what happens in the evolution of human beings, people go do, re, mi, but they don't get to fa. They get stopped at that point. So So the masses of people, they don't attain to the level of a man number four or of the higher types beyond that, a man number five, six, or seven. At one point, Gurdjieff describes Christ as a man number eight, he says, because he attains a sevenfold. I think the number of 777 is often considered the Christ number, but that Gurdjieff describes Christ as a man number eight, so someone who's attained that highest state of possible realization. So this idea that human beings, our evolution doesn't proceed, it proceeds only to a certain point, and then people do not progress further. And Gurdjieff explains that at places where you have missing semitones, you need what he calls a shock. A shock is something from outside of the system which provides a stimulus or impulse to keep the process going, to move through that missing interval and to attain the next level of the cosmic octave, which is fa. And similarly, between C and Do, you need a shock that allows the completion of that octave. And for Gurdjieff, the main shock in terms of the evolution of humankind has to do with conscious influences, higher influences, which provide a shock to a person to awaken them to move forward in this evolutionary process. Have you ever heard anyone else, Jim, talk of evolution in such a way in terms of the, like, cosmic octave or the law of seven? I don't think I have.
No, and that's what I think is so unique about the Gurdjieff teaching is, and the everything you're surrounding his movement is that what I think what he does so brilliantly is that he describes things on different levels and as being obeying the same cosmic principles, the law of three and law of seven. And so he talks about things on a cosmological level, but he also talks about it on a psychological level. And when the deeper you get into this, and the more you understand these things on both cosmological and psychological levels, the more you understand how profound statements or aphorisms such as above, so below, or man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, what that really means. Like you begin to understand that these apparently simple sayings embody that, if you really understood what they were saying, they embody this profound knowledge. And I think the Gurdjieff teaching is especially good at explicating that. I think the whole idea of the octave structure and things, he says that this applies to everything in creation, and this idea that, as you say, do re mi, with a process starts, but it only goes so far, and then if there isn't that external shock which allows the impulse to leap that gap, then it either is retarded or it begins to deflect and becomes something quite different. Like, that's a really profound principle, because he applies it to explain so many things that he says you can apply it to something like look at religion, look at Christianity. And he said, think of how many deviations and how many distortions there must have been in the octave of Christianity to go from Jesus's teaching of the Sermon on the Mount to the Inquisition or to the scholastics during the Middle Ages sitting around trying to calculate how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. All of this proceeds under the name of Christianity, but there's Christianity of a higher person, and there's Christianity which is reflective of these lower levels and these distortions of the original Christian impulse. And you can apply that to anything. It provides a schema to understand how things can start on such a promising level and become so completely distorted and turn into things that are completely antithetical to what they began as. And also this idea of different levels applying to different levels of human beings. And so anything like religion or science, it depends on the level of the human being. That you can talk about religion for man number one, two, or three, but then there's a religion of a higher human being, and this provides a, a, a means of differentiating things that are generally collapsed and interpreted as all being the same thing. People think that you know, Christianity refers to Christians, but there are all sorts of different levels of Christians. That's the point, different types of Christians. And you can say that about anything. That's just an example. But I find that whole idea utterly profound. I know of nothing that even comes close to it in any other teaching.
And then it correlates so beautifully with the yogic view of the chakras, the major energy centers in the human being, because of course in the yogic system there are seven chakras. And in yoga, it is said that most people are ruled by their lowest three chakras related to the motives of money, sex, and power. Or at least those are the motives. Actually, they're the root chakra. If a person is rooted in their root chakra, well, then they have a fundamental ontological security, was the name of R.D. Lang, that they feel established and anchored in life and have that sense of security. If a person doesn't have that, they may try to fill their emptiness or insecurity by amassing wealth, so greed. So that's why the first chakra is associated with money and acquisitions. And the second chakra is called Svadhisthana, her favorite resort, and it's associated with the sexual chakra and the social life of humankind. And so money, sex, and then power is the third chakra, and it's associated with the navel chakra. And the navel is like the emotional clearinghouse for the lower ego. It's like a person's lower emotional center. So we feel anxiety and stress. We can feel it in the solar plexus. Worry, if you feel relaxed, you feel relaxation and warmth in the solar plexus. So good. So in yogic philosophy, see, then once again, people are ruled by the do, re, mi of the chakras, money, sex, and power. And it takes a special effort to get then to the awakening of the fourth chakra, the heart chakra. And one yogi defines yoga as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. And the idea in spiritual psychologies is that our essential self, or I, is connected to the heart. And that's what one of the reason to be of the book The Heart Doctrine, to explain this in all different spiritual traditions, how they connect your essential selfness to the heart. So your higher self isn't above you, above your head, up in the clouds, but it's in the deepest dimensions of the human heart. So in the yogic system, once again, we have that notion of the missing semitone. The people go do, re, mi, but they don't get to that level of self-realization and the awakening of the human heart. So there again, that's where humankind becomes blocked in their evolutionary development. And then it's in spiritual psychology, if a person is then awakened in the heart, that awakens you also to the light of the spiritual self. And that light can then illuminate the higher chakras, the throat chakra, the brow chakra, or the crown chakra. So there are three chakras below the heart and three above. So the heart is kind of in between. And most people's hearts are ruled by the three lower chakras. And the idea in Gurdjieff's system, we want to attain to the level of a man number four and awaken what Gurdjieff calls a higher emotional center. And then the awakening involved in that can illuminate higher centers. And in Gurdjieff's term, it allows for us to experience states of objective consciousness, which is like mystical realizations or insights into the essential nature of the cosmos on various orders of scale. So to develop higher faculties. So the evolution of humankind on this planet, and I think we see this perfectly in the world today, because I think as people are waking up to what's been done in our society over the last 50 years and It's like humankind never got to that level of the awakening of the human heart. Instead, our societies have become run by those people who are, in a way, psychiatrically stuck on those issues of money, sex, and power. And that those individuals have attained control within our society and, in a way, blocked the evolution of humankind on this planet. Any comments, Jim?
Well, I think that's what you're saying about the heart being in the center, and this idea of the scale is really important, and money, sex, and power of the lower chakras in yogic philosophy corresponds exactly with what Gurdjieff is saying. When you look at institutions, like you look at modern psychology, and I would say that modern psychology is stuck in those three lower levels, and
yeah.
Various schools of thought within psychology are the products of a lower level of consciousness, and within themselves they contain some valid and important observations and theoretical perspectives, but what's the problem with them is that there's no recognition of the existence of scale, like of any higher scale of consciousness or being. And so really the whole of modern psychology is like, you know, Uspensky says that you can divide all schools of psychology into two groups. There's a psychology of man as he is, or as rather as people suppose him to be, and then there's the psychologies that deal with the psychology of man's possible evolution, which is like the fulfillment of his higher capabilities and capacities and his connection to higher dimensions of consciousness and being. And there's nothing in modern psychology. It's really like, again, psychology has become such, in the 20th century, became such a distorted enterprise that it actually did away with consciousness for the longest time. And now that it's readmitted, it's really recognized only as being the product of the brain. I mean, it's assumed that consciousness is the product of the human brain, and this is just a huge epistemological assumption which is based on nothing really other than people's misunderstanding of themselves, at least from an esoteric and mystical perspective. And the great shock that has never occurred, which is essential to modern psychology's progression, is to recognize the existence of these ancient psychologies, which are much more sophisticated in understanding the different levels of consciousness and being that exist, and the possibility of people to transform themselves and transcend them, their normal waking states. And that's what's, in a way, that's like, you know, the whole thrust of your work and my work and everything that anybody who's interested in these ancient esoteric psychologies is to try to provide that shock to modern psychology and modern thought. Like, I see, given this, you know, 30 years of plus of studying this material, I see how almost everything is fundamentally misunderstood about everything, because people don't recognize that these different levels of existence and scale. So almost everything is couched in terms of theories that are based on a set of, I would say, erroneous assumptions about the nature of human beings and the universe. And so it's like, it's kind of like being the boy who sees that the emperor's wearing no clothes. Like, in and of themselves, many of these theories and ideas have some application and have some validity, but they're incomplete because they fail to recognize the existence of this scale. And that's where the idea of the octave is so important. And also the idea of the law of three, because of an inherent aspect of the normal waking state of consciousness of human beings is to see everything dualistically rather than in terms of its true triune nature, which is another aspect of the illusion of modern knowledge and the illusory basis of the assumptive framework of modern knowledge, I would say.
Yeah, it's amazing, like those very basic principles of the laws of three and seven. If you understand that, in my view, you have a whole new heuristic in science. And what I mean by the word heuristic is a way of thinking about phenomena or approaching their study. Like, in Western psychology, psychologists don't know it, but they tend to think in twos. That's a Gurdjieff term. He says, we're always thinking in twos. We always see any phenomena. We find one phenomena and we look for its opposite. Or we always consider anything has two parts to it. And you see that dualistic thinking throughout modern psychology. If you go to a textbook, What is Psychology? It defines a psychology as the science of mind and behavior and regards human beings as having a dual nature. You have a mind or brain in the head, and that's connected to the material body. So it's a simplistic, dualistic mind-body science. Whereas right away in the Gurdjieff teaching, Gurdjieff says a human being functions mainly mentally, emotionally, and physically. Head, heart, and hands. Thinking, feeling, and movement sensation. So right in the core of psychology is that fundamental duality of the mind-body, and then people wonder, can the mind affect the body? And they have all these Cartesian dualities. And then they think, if they ask the question, is there something immaterial in man that connects to the material body? So they think, again, dualistically. Or they think in terms of the left brain and the right brain, or conscious, unconscious, stimulus, response. It's so much dualistic. Whereas with a mystical background, you kind of look always to see the triune and sevenfold nature of any phenomena. So in my view, a human being functions mentally, emotionally, and physically. Those three aspects to our nature. And then we have the system of seven centers. So we have a triune and sevenfold nature, not simply a dualistic one. It's such a more complex way of differentiating the parts of the elephant, in a sense, meaning the elephant is the phenomena we're trying to understand. If everybody thinks in twos, then what if the elephant doesn't have two parts? So Gurdjieff calls human beings, he says, in our normal state of consciousness, we are third force blind, and that we have to come to recognize third force in all things. And that's a very profound teaching. And any time you can find any duality, and you can consider it and find a third force that establishes a triunity. And this is a basic principle of Pythagorean number theory, for Pythagoras said, establish the triangle. And this idea of the triune nature of creation, it's the basis of Kabbalah with the tree of life. You have the three supernal spheres, which give birth to the seven spheres below. And the tree of life is founded on three pillars. And you have all these different triangles within the tree of life. And then you find it in the Vedic teachings of India, where they say all the phenomena of nature are due to modifications of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And they represent intelligence, energy, and matter. And then you compare that to Western science, and you find out Western science, again, has been mainly dualistic. We think everything's only matter or energy. And now in the New Age thinking, they say, oh, all matter is really energy, and energy cannot be created or destroyed. And that's the New Age kind of thinking that, yeah, all matter is really energetic. But really, there's a deeper teaching that all matter has a triune nature, a material, energetic, and intelligence aspect to it. So it provides a triunity that compare with the dualities of mainstream science. And that provides a whole new perspective on the issues of science. And we find in modern physics, scientists are now beginning to think that there is intelligence inherent within space and within the zero-point fields. So in the new science emerging, intelligence is regarded as a third force, which is latent within the medium, just as Gurdjieff described. He said you don't see third force. It's latent within the medium, and the medium is in space. So it's like there's this intelligence inherent within space that is the mediating force. A very profound concept.
Yeah, that's a really important thing when Gurdjieff says about being third force blind. One of the comments he adds to that is that often the third force is latent within the medium and is invisible, but that, you know, you have to recognize that its importance and its significance, which is exactly, as you say, what's happening in modern physics, is more and more people are recognizing that latent within everything is this intelligence, and that it's, you know, that it's not just, everything isn't just an outcome of matter and energy. It's matter to energy and intelligence, which again is consistent with every major religious teaching. It's in the Christian Trinity, it's in the Zazahat in Kabbalah, it's in the Gunas in Hinduism. It's within every major teaching, this idea of the Holy Trinity.
Yeah, and it's so profound when you apply it and actually apply it to science, you see the dualistic thinking, and you can see how when you apply third, fourth thinking, it gives you new insights into really any topic you would attempt to consider.
Yeah.
So those are the basic principles then of mystical creation. And I would say in the esoteric studies that Jim and I have been presenting through these last 4 years, we try to explain this, what I would call a magical formula in a sense, is that the one is divided by three and yields seven. Similarly, white light divided by a prism, threefold prism, gives a spectrum of seven colors, the one, the three, and the seven. And that principle of design is inherent to nature. In any area, psychology, physics, chemistry, any area, you can apply that type of 1-3-7 thinking. And as I attempt to do in my work, there's all kinds of application of it.
Gurdjieff also used those ideas to explain the difference between what he called subjective and objective art. And he taught sacred dances, which he had studied widely in his travels throughout the Mid and Far East, and sacred, what are called sacred gymnastics, and came to America in the 20s and gave demonstrations of these dances, and was working for many years on the ballet, The Struggle of the Magicians. When he first came to New York, A.R. Oraj, who was his pupil, introduced the demonstration of the dances. I just want to read a little bit of this, Chris. These gymnastics had a double aim. They contain and express a certain form of knowledge, and at the same time serve as a means to acquire a harmonious state of being. The farthest possible limits of one's strength are known through the combination of unnatural movements in the individual gymnastics, which help to obtain certain qualities of sensation, various degrees of concentration, and the requisite directing of thought and the senses. And then, in this book that I'm quoting from, they describe that the dancers began in an almost military order of seven files and three rows, but costumed with quite unmilitary softness. Both men and women wore white tunics over full white trousers gathered at the ankle, and the tunics were belted with wide sashes in the seven colors of the spectrum. And for the first few moments, the dancers stood in the order, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Though they remained so for the obligatories, which is the name of the sacred gymnastics, their swift movement and complex figures appeared to make the colors change and shift. Someone in the audience said that it seemed like watching white light pass very slowly through a prism and breaking into a spectral order. So that's an example.
Wow, that's amazing. He actually incorporated that into choreography of his
choreography dance. Of the
sacred
dances.
Movements.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, and like even in the designing of the costumes, you know, that it wasn't random. It was very carefully thought out that these would represent the colors of the spectrum, and so that the actual movements are embodying this principle, the one, the three, and the seven, as you often quote, like, the, you know, an example of the, of that is white light passing through a three-sided prism and breaking into the spectrum of seven colors. Like, that's a basic illustration of the fundamental cosmic laws, that the idea, the aphorism that God is first one, then three, then seven.
Yeah, it amazes me. You know, in modern physics, I read Shapley, a scientist at one point, and said that modern physics concerns itself with four main entities, matter and energy, time and space. And he said all the laws of physics are variations, involve these four elements in various variations. And I find that if you take each of those elements, you can apply the 1-3-7 analysis. So, for instance, we take energy. The first example, energy is electromagnetic radiation. Well, it's called electromagnetic because it's electric and it has magnetic properties, but the light propagates along what's called the pointing vector, which is the neutral point between the electric and the magnetic side. So light itself has a triune nature. And then it produces this spectrum of seven colors. And then you can, that's energy. Then you can look at matter. And matter is composed of three primary material particles, protons, electrons, and neutrons. And these form atoms which assemble in seven rows of the periodic tables. So the sevenfoldness is built right into the chemistry of life, in terms of the elements of chemistry. Now, that's matter and that's energy. You can apply them both there. Then we come to time. Well, in time, we often consider the triunity of the past, present, and future. And in all triunities, usually two of the elements are contrasting principles, like the past and the future, while the third element, in a way, mediates those and is in between those, and that's like the now. So if you imagined a number line representing time, and you put a zero point, like an origin point, that would be the now. And spread out infinitely in one direction, you would have the past, and in the other direction, you would have the future. But that moment of now is like the instant, the zero point instant of now. Anyway, so, and the other thing with time is, according to Blavatsky, see, Blavatsky says everything in the physical as well as the metaphysical universes are structured on the law of seven. She, in her creation physics, she describes how hyperspace is seven dimensional even before creation happens. And then when creation happens, sevenfold hyperspace gives birth to seven planes of existence. And in the stanza in her Secret Doctrine, it reads seven inside, seven outside. So that the seven inside is in hyperspace, and then the world is created, it creates seven outside, seven planes of being. Okay, so these principles of the laws of three and seven. Okay, so time. I was going about time. Well, one example would be the Shakespeare talk, I think, about the seven ages of man. You know, at first the infant mewling and puking in its mother's arms, and then the whining schoolboy, and I forget all stages, but the idea that there are seven stages to a human being's life. But Blavatsky also says that existence occurs in seven cycles of creation, what she calls seven rounds. And each of these rounds has seven sub-rounds. And each sub-round has seven races and seven root races. And Blavatsky actually claims that we are currently in the fourth round of creation on planet Earth, the fourth cycle of life, and that we are the fifth root race. of the fourth cycle. So that is also revealed in these ancient stanzas of Zen. It says, count, follow the wheels and count the spokes, and you realize that you are on the fourth wheel. And then we're said to be entering this fifth level of human evolution on the fourth cycle. So that's time. And the last one is space. And space is usually, and we can consider it as a one, as meaning just space taken as a whole. But then if you divide space down, we usually think of our space as three-dimensional, because any point could be represented as a function of X, Y, and Z coordinates. So we live in three-dimensional space. But then you can break space down differently, as the natives do. And you might, firstly, you might move to the right or to the left. You might move forward or backwards. You might move up or down. So those are six dimensions. And the seventh dimension is at the center of the whole coordinate system, and that would be in the human heart. So the zero point center is within the heart, and that is the seventh direction. So you can view space also as having a triune and sevenfold nature. So all the elements of the physicists, matter, energy, time, and space, can all be conceived as having a triune and sevenfold nature. And then even in Blavatsky further, you find that not only space is seven-dimensional, but she also says hyperspace is seven-dimensional. And the newest models of physics in science postulate a seven-dimensional hyperspace existing at every point underlying the manifest world. And that's perfectly consistent with some of Blavatsky's claims. It really is the ideas of the laws in three and seven. I remember, Jim, 30 years ago, first reading the book, The Fourth Way, and Uspensky mentioning, oh, these are fundamental cosmic laws, the law of three and the law of seven. And I thought, like, well, how foolish. How can you have a law in the number like that? Like, it just didn't make any sense, even though the examples they gave were very interesting. But I think it's taken us like 30 years of study to really appreciate the subtlety and profound application of those concepts. And it really gives a whole alternative way of criticizing or critiquing other materials when you see people's dualistic thinking and their limited concepts.
Yeah, I think, as you say, that was my reaction at first. It's like, well, whatever, you know, I'll sort of suspend my judgment about that because I was so impressed by various aspects of the psychological teaching being presented that I knew that I didn't know. That's the thing, and I just sort of let it be. But as you study things more and more, I think that you do begin to realize that, as you say, at the very least, this is an incredibly useful heuristic for studying all sorts of different phenomena, all sorts of different ideas in philosophy and science and to see it in within yourself, like to understand octave structures, like to recognize them. I think there's nothing quite like this idea, that, especially of the octave structure, that to sort of open your eyes to another way of understanding things. I know for me, one of the things that really convinced me, the first thing that I really understood in terms of the trinity of things, was when you began to criticize in your writing, I think it was actually part of your doctoral thesis, when you pointed out how various discussions of the nature of self and consciousness and mind in modern psychology were always formulated in a dualistic way, and that this was sort of an inherent self element of psychological theorizing. And I see that so clearly. I was immediately impressed by it, but I see it so clearly now. It's like, part of that is that when somebody tries to think about something, they come up with a concept and that they want to examine, and then they think about the concept, and then they think about, well, what's the opposite of that concept? And then when they have the opposite, they then jump to the conclusion that they now have the totality of the phenomena understood. Like, it's like you think of one thing, then you automatically try to name it second thing, and then you assume that you've completely understood something. And it's when you start to think of things in those terms, you realize like how much of what passes for intellectual formulations and intellectual discussions is really what Gurdjieff says is formatory thinking, and that's the idea in Gurdjieff that really jumped out at me, which deals with the law of three, is that he says the most mechanical aspects of thinking always involves thinking in twos, like thinking of something and then thinking of its opposite, and concluding that you've described the entire phenomena. At the very least, like these two ideas, the ideas of, like, as you say, when you originally read the two fundamental cosmic laws, like, yeah, right, you know, like, whatever, it just doesn't make any sense, but it seems kind of silly and arbitrary, but it's not silly and it's not arbitrary the more you study it. And I mean, in 30 years, I think you've made incredible progress in understanding these things. And then the other side of it, too, is that when you begin to read with this idea in mind, you begin to realize how these ideas have recurred throughout human history. Like, there's nothing, they're not peculiar simply to Gurdjieff in the fourth wave, but he expresses this, especially the law of the octave, the law of seven, he expresses, I think, in a much more direct way than perhaps other teachings. But then you read somebody like Blavatsky and this whole idea of like seven inside, seven outside, like it's very, very profound. And at the very least, it's an extraordinary way to look at everything, to try to understand things.
And the fact that you find the same concepts in Tibetan Buddhism, the Dalai Lama, he talks about the seven chakras, the 49 planes of existence. You find it in Kabbalah with the supernal triad and the seven spheres created below. You find it in Christianity. You find it in the yogic Vedic teachings with the three gunas and the seven realms of Maya. You find the consistency of these principles in all these esoteric teachings. That's why I think this is an ancient teaching that's in a way been lost in the evolution of modern religion. It kind of takes us back to what you were saying before. Religions became matters of dogma and rote, and people lost an understanding of the secret teachings of the religious traditions. We've lost the keys to understanding those things. And I think the laws of three and seven are keys to unlocking the mysteries of the occultism and life. These are profound mystery keys to learn to see things and understand phenomena in these terms.
And I mean, you know, there's so many different aspects to it. I mean, within the fourth way teaching too, Gurdjieff has the whole idea of the three being foods and how we can digest foods on different levels according to our level of consciousness, and how like the act of remembering oneself actually serves as a shock which transmutes and alchemically changes the foods that we feed on. Air, mental impressions, and food as we normally understand it are the three types of food. In yogic teachings, you have the three channels, you know, the three main channels for conveying prana through the chakras. These ideas recur again and again, this idea of 137, 137. It's just like it's so critical, you know.
And it also, so much it makes sense, because in the mystical tradition, they see creation as being, in a way, materialization out of divine light, or what's sometimes called the lux, L-U-X. Like there's this form of supernal light. So we see how with physical light, the law, the 137 principle applies. But so we can conceive how, well, if there was a form of supernal lux, well, the same principles of the triune and sevenfold nature of that light might apply to that light in terms of the creation of material realities. So the idea of the 1, 3, and 7, the way that is like the dynamics of light. And light is like Yogananda calls it the structural essence of creation. And in a way, and that's consistent with what David Bohm says. Like, yeah. David Bohm says that everything is like solidified light, that light that's kind of trapped within different quantum system. So it's entrapped light, which is like Blavatsky says. She describes light as the great protean magician, and says that light, that its rays give birth to all these different forms on different dimensions and so on. So light is a great protean magician. So it all follows to apply these concepts of the laws of 3 and 7. And there's so many valuable examples of it. The more I study science, yeah. It's like in science, you know, there's three families of elementary particles.
Yeah.
Hadrons, heavy particles, leptons, light particles, and gluons, which carry the main four fundamental forces and are the elements that bind and convey the forces of nature. So there's three classes of elementary particles. And then you find out that there are three generations of these classes of elementary particles.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's accepted in science. And they're wondering, why are there only three generations? You know, so it's like that, the threefoldness appears over and over again. You can look at all the different equations in science, like F equals MA, force is equal to mass times acceleration.
Right.
Well, the force is the energy principle, the mass is the material principle, and the acceleration is the third phenomena. Well, it's related to intelligence, but it's inherent within the medium of how the force applied to the matter, how that's transformed, because there's intelligence within the medium. So you can take different equations and you find the threefoldness inherent in an equation. In fact, you can't have an equation with only two elements. It doesn't make sense. You have to have three elements to have an equation.
Yeah, there's a quote from Newton that, to the effect that why may not nature change light into bodies and bodies into light?
Wow.
Yeah, you know, Newton was very heavily influenced and interested in occult and alchemical texts and played a major part in his thought. I love that quote because it's entirely consistent with the yogic teachings and with the esoteric and mystical teachings, right? Like there's nothing really distinct about it, like or different about it. It's not at all opposed to occult teachings.
No. Another example I like too, like thinking in these ways, like how they're keys to unlocking the mysteries and things. Like I think of I remember as a child reading the first book of Genesis. I was like, wow, what is that? You know, and trying through my life to try to understand what it says. Is it meant literally? Is it meant metaphorically? Or what other principles are inherent in the book of Genesis? Like, it's a mystery teaching in a way. So it's something we have to understand. And Kabbalists understand this really well because they kind of understand all they apply number analysis to all the letters. There's a whole science of trying to understand those chapters. But even if we take the first book of Genesis, okay, it says, in the beginning, kind of threefold, but that's not important. In the beginning, God created heaven and the earth. Okay, so your first triunity, God created the heaven and the earth. So a world above in spirit, the spiritual world, and a world below, a material world. So that's your first triunity, God, heaven, and the earth. And the second book, in the second verse, it says, and the earth was empty and void, which is, of course, very interesting in modern science because scientists now believe at one point before history, the earth was empty and void. The universe was empty and void. It hadn't been created yet. It rested in non-being. Okay, so that's what Genesis describes. It describes a period before material creation exists. Okay, so, and then it says, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Okay, so you have the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Okay, well, the Spirit of God would represent the element fire. And in magic, the symbol for fire is an upward turned triangle. Okay, so, and the Spirit of God moved across the face of the waters. And the waters represents a divine feminine principle of water or space itself. So the magical symbol for water is a downward turned triangle. So the Spirit of God moved across the face of the waters. If you represented this symbolically or geometrically, what you would represent is two overlapping triangles, which is the Seal of Solomon, or the Seal of Solomon. It's also, which is the six-pointed star. Same as on the Israeli flag, the Seal of Solomon, or I was trying to remember, what's the other David's?
Star of David.
Star of David, yes, thank you. Okay, so that's the Star of David. The Spirit of God moving across the face of the waters, that actually embodies the Star of David in the geometry of what that line says. And then God says, let there be light. So, and then there's that first point of light of creation. So you might imagine putting that point of light at the center of the Star of David. So then instead of having a six-pointed star, you have a seventh-pointed star. And in Blavatsky, she says, the understanding the seventh element in the Star of David, you need the seventh element at the center of the Star of David. And in the teachings of theosophy, instead of having a point within the Star of David, what they have is the Ankh from Egypt. And the Ankh in Egypt represents the life principle. An Ankh looks like a cross, except the upper part of the cross is a circle, like a head, instead of a line. So Blavatsky has this seventh element in the Star of David, and that is the key to the Star of David. See, I would say that the Star of David, without a central element, can represent a lower symbol. Whereas you put an Ankh or a center point in the Star of David, it transforms it from a figure, a six-sided figure, into the seventh. See, the Star of David, in a way, it has six lines. It's two triangles of three lines, and it has six angles. So you could represent the number 666 with the Star of David. But then if you put a seventh element in the center, it transforms the meaning of that symbol. So that's a very sacred symbol. And Blavatsky points out the Star of David isn't simply of Jewish or Hebraic origin. It's also called the Vishnu's shield in Hindu teachings, and it's also in other ancient Egyptian teachings, and that, she says, is a ancient symbol in many, many different traditions. It's not only a Jewish symbol. Very beautiful symbol. I know, yeah. As I've studied that more and more in my own writing, trying to understand the seventh element within the Star of David, because that symbol is a perfect symbol for the heart chakra, because you have the heart chakra, which is the point, and then you have the three chakras above and the three below.
Yeah.
So you overlap that all over the heart chakra. And in ancient Hinduism, the Star of David with the central point is actually the symbol used within the heart chakra. So it all, again, confirms these ancient notions.
Yeah, wow. Very interesting. You look at symbols, and then as you learn more about these ideas and different interpretations of things, you begin to understand that, well, these symbols aren't just, you know, sort of arbitrarily constructed symbols, that they have very deep meaning behind them, and your level of interpretation deepens with your knowledge and your understanding of what these things are meant to embody. It's like with the verbal formulas, you know, you can say, oh, as above, so below. Yeah, okay, sure. You know, that means this. But the more you study esoteric and mystical ideas, the deeper your level of knowledge of these things and your deeper the level of your understanding is, and you realize how incredibly profound that this ostensibly simple statement is. And it's the same with these symbols. Like, you know, even like 20 years ago, would you have understood this about the Star of David or the Seal of Solomon? No.
No, would that have helped me along more quickly if someone explained it so
somebody
quickly to me?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It was like, you know, there's so many aspects of these things. It would have been a lot easier if somebody had just told me this, you know. Like, I mean, it's fun to, it's a grand adventure to discover these things and to learn them and to contemplate them. But, you know, that's where to really be taught by somebody who really knows something, it would be very, very useful, you know. If there's anybody out there who really knows something, I'd really like to hear from you.
Well, I mean, that's what, I mean, it's funny, in a way, that's what we've done through our lives. We've made the effort to study those books and texts produced by people who were supposedly or claimed to have acquired occult knowledge, had divine realizations, attained higher states of consciousness. I mean, that's what we did. We took the path of trying to study, well, what are these people saying? I mean, that's what I did. I wanted to understand what is human consciousness. And I explored Western psychology, and I realized, like, they didn't really understand consciousness. And then I started exploring the spiritual psychologies, and there's a whole other view of what consciousness is. So, yeah, it's been a lifelong pursuit. And then it's to understand these things not only in words, but to have experiences which over time kind of deepen and deepen your intellectual knowledge of things.
Yeah. And,
it's an interesting
process. Yeah, well, and again, it's that the journey is really the most important part in a way. But it is interesting, too, in terms of this debate between science and religion, or between secular thought and religion, that's so, you know, prevalent today, and which is
that dualistic debate.
Well, you realize, I mean, it's hard to explain to people. You realize, like, you know, if you say to somebody, well, like, if you take somebody like Richard Dawkins, and you say, like, Richard Dawkins really doesn't know very much about religion and doesn't know very much about God, and he's a microbiologist and a very accomplished one and very clever guy and everything. But if you say, you know, I think his book is nonsense, people automatically make all sorts of assumptions about what you must believe, you know. I was like, I mean, I believe in God, but again, like, it's like what Carl Sagan said years ago. Well, people say they believe in God. Well, what do you actually mean by that? And I mean, that's a very good question. What do you actually mean by that? And my conceptualization of God has evolved over the past 30 years. I believe in God. I'm not sure exactly how I would identify or articulate that, but it's not a two-line answer. It's a very complex answer. I mean, in a way, I believe God is the eternal nothingness, the void, if you want to put it in those terms. I mean, if you want to try to articulate in terms of the English language, I think God is the void. You know, it's like it's the void in the plenum. It's like there's something that beyond everything, which is the ultimate zero. But you know, those are just words.
But which is paradoxically everything at the same time. Like it's paradoxical.
It's yeah. But I don't believe in God who sits around in his underwear, you know, counting sparrows and telling flowers to open, like with the way Carl Sagan portrays God. You know, like that's not. I mean, I don't believe in that God, and I don't believe in God who who intervenes, you know, to determine the outcome of baseball games. I don't really think that's the, you know, that's not my, the kind of God I believe in. But, you know, there are people who do believe in that kind of God, you know, and
yeah.
God bless them, you know. At the same time, I think, like, in terms of, it's a very complex thing. It's like, it's not an either or. It's not a dualistic question, you know. It's like, I believe there are people who are profoundly spiritual who don't believe in God, you know, who
yeah.
in their actions and in their attitudes, I think, are much more profoundly spiritual than many so-called believers, you know. So again, it's a very subtle question, and it really, any meaningful discussion of it has to be examined in light of a real knowledge of consciousness, I believe, and that's what's missing from the discussion, is that people don't understand how the questions and the answers are both reflective of our understanding and our knowledge of consciousness. And again, going back to what we began to discuss at the beginning of the program, if you just believe that all that consciousness is just a basic human awareness, and that it doesn't exist on any different levels, and that they're just like, there are people who are awake and there are people who are asleep, and that's it. Well, if that's all you believe, then I would say that your understanding of these questions is impossibly limited, and that's it. Like, so much of this discussion is formatory in Gurdjieff's terms in that sense. It's very simplistic, it's very, very much dualistic, and it doesn't recognize the complexity and the subtleties of the questions and the answers. So much of the debate is completely phony because it reduces everything to these fundamental levels, and there are many more different various nuances and levels of interpretation and explanation that really put the question into a much broader context.
Yeah, in so many ways. But people don't have the language even to address those issues very much.
Yeah.
I want to just say two things, like how... like that question, like, well, what do we mean by God? And one thing I wanted to say about that is, like, how to me, the issue of God is very much tied into the issue of whether or not human beings have a soul or spiritual or divine nature. That a human being has some higher, I don't know how, you can use different ways of describing this, but some higher or hidden or metaphysical life force or consciousness principle within them. Okay, so to me, if a human being, we survive physical death and we can go into realms and encounter other spiritual beings or have other lives or exist in afterlife worlds, well then in a way that can add support to this notion that there's God, that all of life wasn't simply material matter evolving material beings that live and die with the body, but no, there was some inner being that was inhabiting that physical body. So I see the issue of the existence of God is very closely tied into the issue of the existence or non-existence of the human soul. Because that's how we would know God anyway, is if we had a soul or spiritual nature. So I think that's a very important angle on this issue of the existence of God and what we mean by God. Because I think partly what people mean by God is that we're not simply the body. There's something in us that survives death and can exist in other dimensions or in other lifetimes. So I think that's one, the soul hypothesis. Is tied into the issue of this issue of the existence of God. And the second, and that's why in many ways I think all the overwhelming evidence that exists for out-of-body experiences, psychical phenomena, reincarnation, past life memories, and all the psychical phenomena, I think, give evidence for the existence of the human soul. Something in us that can survive the loss of the physical body or physical death. So I think it provides evidence for that, which then, in a way, adds credence to the proposition of the existence of God. Now, it doesn't prove it, but it adds credence to it, supportive evidence and argument. And the second thing that I want to say about this, what do we mean by God? And I like how Blavatsky, I quote her in the beginning of my book on the secret doctrine, and she says something. She says, well, we don't believe in the bearded patriarch. Like, that's not our notion, an anthropomorphic notion of God. But she says that she believes in there being divine workmen or masons, that intelligences or divine beings, which in a way fashion the void, that God himself kind of doesn't do everything personally, but instead God creates intelligences, or the one God manifests as the seven logi or seven luminous suns or seven rays, but that those are the workmen, the divine intelligences which help to sculpt the void. And then I think there are these intelligences on different levels, divine ones and then spiritual intelligences, that they're all different levels of intelligences. So I think that's another aspect of what we mean by God. Like, I see God, as I understand that, I have a more abstract notion of the absolute, this kind of plenum void, unspeakable thing. That you would speak of, you were speaking of. But then on a lower level, that God manifests, it's said in the stanzas of Zen that the seven luminous suns are already inherent in non-existence before creation happens. So they aren't created, the seven luminous suns. Instead, they simply emerge out of the matrix of non-being. So the seven luminous suns, they emanate. So I have that notion of there being intelligences, beings that create and fashion the world, and that the laws of nature are the manifestations of their influences and their intelligences. But you don't ever see anyone approach the arguments to consider those kinds of possibilities in the debates over the intelligent design issue, at least as far as I've ever read. Have you ever come across anything like that, Jim? Or?
No, not really. Yeah, and I like what you just said, you know, when you're saying about the soul hypothesis. I mean, it really is another expression of the idea about the nature of consciousness and whether or not consciousness ends with the death of the physical body. Like, if it doesn't, then you know, everything is placed on an entirely different level of understanding. But again, like what you said, is I'm trying to understand this. I'm an empiricist, and you know, by disposition and by training, intellectually, I'm an empiricist, and I would say that, like, in my study of this, like, that I think the evidence is overwhelming. That's why I say I believe in God. I think the evidence is overwhelming that that the existence of higher spiritual realities is a fact, and that there are higher spiritual entities, and you know what they are. You know, I don't know if these are angels or what, but. And that there is some sort of, as you say, I would think of it in more abstract terms, of some sort of absolute intelligence, which is unnameable and unspeakable in a sense, and so beyond categorization and beyond intellectual discrimination, but knowable, because people have had these experiences and of knowing God within their heart and knowing God directly. So
and there I think that might occur on different levels too, and it's not simply an all or one thing.
That
we might have different levels of awakening and self-realization and enlightenment, and that could be like many levels to that.
There was something else that you said that I forgot what I was going to react to what you said, but I thought, well, I think you stated it very well, though, that the idea of like, I always like that quote from Blavatsky, like you say, that you use, is that, you know, that in terms of, like, the personalized anthropomorphic God, no, we don't believe in that. But it's like that other quote from her, that there's this one absolute omniscient intelligence which thrills through every finite point of creation. And that's kind of how I understand God, is that there is an intelligence behind all manifestations in the universe, and that somehow all of this is happening within and without that absolute intelligence, you know? Like it's
yeah,
somehow
yeah,
expression of that, but yeah. It's also contained within that, and then
yeah.
we're all interacting with that intelligence, which is, you know, which is behind everything. I was reading the other day in the Jonathan Cott book, when he talked to Robert Frager, who's a psychotherapist and a Sufi in Los Angeles, and he has a book on Sufism, which is really interesting. And he's talking about angels, and he said angels never forget God. So, like, angels are like this level of perfected consciousness that their intelligence is that don't forget God, that they you know, so mm-hmm. like they would be like level 7, or you know, something like these higher beings. And again, yeah. this is an idea that's easy to kind of mock and to dismiss as being superstitious and everything, because there's so many different distortions and allusions to this idea of these higher beings that have sort of filtered through the popular imagination and culturally over thousands of years. Different spin-offs have happened, but this idea that there are higher intelligences is a very profound idea, and something that can't and I don't think should be dismissed out of hand, but try to suspend your belief and disbelief and just try to understand what this might involve, you know, and that this idea that there are higher beings whose consciousness is so perfected that they never forget God, which again, it's something that's easy to say, but it's difficult to understand what you actually mean by that. But it comes back to like this idea that we don't remember ourselves in our normal waking state of consciousness, and that when we try to begin to remember ourselves, we realize that to be conscious and to be conscious in higher states is possible, but it's very, very difficult. It's a long way from where we are in our normal waking state. And yet, by trying to do this, like the exercise of actually trying to remember ourselves begins to open our eyes to the idea of the possibility of the grand scale of human consciousness and what actually is attainable by people. Even to have a little taste of what a higher state of consciousness or a more awakened state of consciousness is, begins to really reconstitute your entire understanding of everything. Like, you see how everything attains to new possibilities or suggests new possibilities, and that's the experiential and understanding aspect of this whole thing. It's like we talked a lot about intellectual aspects of it, but all of this is grounded in the attempt to know oneself, and through the practices of self-remembering and various types of meditation, you begin to understand that you have an experiential basis for an empirical experiential basis for trying to understand things or believing that things are not what they seem and that can be understood in entirely different terms. And that's where that interplay and that synthesis between knowledge and understanding occurs, is that you work on yourself and you work on knowing more and understanding more, and these things reinforce one another so that you begin to have a radically different understanding of everything, possibilities for everything, including the nature of God.
Well, I certainly understand ourselves to live in a multidimensional universe, and that's amazing. Like,
yeah.
You know, to have existence beyond death and live different lives, or to live in other time periods and dimensions. I mean, to imagine such concepts of what it means to be a human being and have a human existence are so utterly profound compared with the kind of dismal nothingness of modern materialist science, which kind of pretends that we're only these biological organisms and there's no evidence for anything else, and they can't prove their theories. And they hide their eyes to all the evidences which point to the existence of all these other dimensions. And you come to a certain point where, in a way, to deny it is pseudoscientific. You know, it's like you just, I mean, I think it was 30 years ago, I came to accept that these phenomena were real, and that the problem wasn't to try to prove the phenomena. At that time, I was particularly studying the near-death experiences and all the experiences and places people visit and so on. But we needed to try to understand a physics or science which would enable us to understand how these things are possible. And that has to kind of be a science of multi-dimensional reality. And that's kind of what, you know, I developed through my work on Blavatsky, is like how hyperspace is seven-dimensional and creation is seven-dimensional and we're seven-dimensional beings, you know, and we all embody these principles in ourselves as microcosms of the macrocosm, and how you know, creation is manifested out of light, and between our scale of living as human beings, as you go down into different levels of the quantum vacuum, there are so many interior hidden dimensions of interrelatedness and interconnectedness between things, that there's this whole complex inner structure within things and within space itself, that, like, as you approach zero point levels. Yeah, there's this incredible kind of inward complexity to everything in life. And my belief now, if I had to say what my belief is that at the essence of my being, there's a divine source emanation. It's like Aleister Crowley says, every man and every woman is a star. We have a divine spark or God spark within us, and that's in kind of higher dimensional space. And that has certain properties, and that element is clothed in different bodies. And we live in different dimensions as we're clothed in different bodies. And I was reading a very interesting section of The Secret Doctrine, Jim. I've been rereading the book as I do my final edits of it. Mm-hmm. Such an interesting section on Blavatsky explaining how, like, there are these different rounds. And she was saying how in each round there are seven major planets that constitute the central planets of that round. But then when that round ends and a new round begins, as the round ends, the life principle in each planet withdraws into the planet, into its Leia center, and then it's transferred into a new planet in the next round. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so you kind of withdraw into a zero-point center, and you emerge from a new zero-point center in another round. And Blavatsky saw the moon, she says. The moon was a planet, like one of the seven essential planets on an earlier round. Uh-huh. But when that round ends, well, then as the life principle withdraws from the moon, it leaves the shell behind.
Right.
And the moon is like the shell of what was a planet in the prior round. So it's an amazing concept, and it reminds me, like, this is like what is said about the spiritual soul between different lives. And the theosophists have a description of how, like, when you die in your physical body, you pass over into the astral planes and live a certain period of time in the astral plane according to your astral makeup. And then you shed your astral body, and you may have briefer or longer periods in the mental realm. And then you kind of pass back to the sun, and then like you withdraw into the spiritual world, and the atom is stripped of all its associations, And then once again, you begin to form a new mental body, a new astral body, and a new physical body. So you descend again into being incarnated. So you can imagine the kind of movement between lives, like in and out of zero point centers. Interesting concept, how we might move through dimensions.
Yeah, you know, going back to something you said earlier too, that I just wanted to comment on, was that the idea of trying to rather than just denying outright or being skeptical, so called, about claims for esoteric and mystical claims about the nature of consciousness and the nature of being and reality and everything, and how, like in your experience with life after death experiences, rather than trying to prove or disprove that whether or not these phenomena were real, just sort of accepting them and trying to understand how they might be true. It's like, it's that kind of open-mindedness to things and a willing to sort of suspend your disbelief and investigate them on their own terms leads to a very, very different, I think a very uncommon and different intellectual approach to things, which I think is incredibly rewarding, not only because the phenomena themselves are so fascinating in various aspects of these things, like studying consciousness within yourself or studying certain psychic phenomena. In itself, it's very interesting, it's very rewarding, but I think we live in a time when the development of science has provides like a complementary body of knowledge which makes these things more explicable and more understandable if you accept them as being real, and if you try to understand things in terms of mystical and esoteric teachings. Like, there's a complementarity, I think, of science, and it's not, there's not like a conflict between science and aspects of science. Like, yeah, there is a conflict between certain scientific ideas and interpretations and understandings, but really there's a real possibility to reach a new synthesis in human knowledge and understanding by taking mystical and esoteric explanations and trying to have a dialogue with modern science. Like, it's very clear. I mean, that's the whole significance of your work, but it's very clear that you know, that there's immense possibilities to understand things and know things in new ways by you know, trying to combine these ideas from the two different approaches.
Yes, certainly mystical ideas become ever more conceivable in the light of the modern physics. I mean,
yeah.
This idea of modern physics now about how, like, all manifest phenomena, like the out product of, you know, seven-dimensional hyperspace and elements in these higher-dimensional spaces, like, concepts like that, like, are perfectly in accord. Like, you can understand how there could be higher dimensions in the new holographic model.
Right.
That this is so profound, and I'd like to try to explain this on one show, even though it's so complex, but I need to try to learn how to explain it a little bit. But what I develop in the book on the secret doctrine is explaining how the new models of black holes in alternative anti-de Sitter space, the activities of black holes in this hyperspace dimension are rendered equivalent to the particle physics that occurs on the holographic boundaries, the shells surrounding this black hole, and how this kind of model of having these little kind of mini black holes in hyperspace act like an information processor in modern physics. And that's, in a way, the spinergy, the spin energy of this, like, monad in hyperspace kind of creates bodies out of the fields of the ether surrounding that central point. Like, the newest concepts in holographic physics provide a profound explanation of how the dynamics of such a thing might work.
Wow.
Yeah. because this little monad in hyperspace, it has spin properties, because
right.
it's a modification of the eternal ceaseless breath. And this spin of the ceaseless breath is modified on 7 invisible points. That's how Blavatsky describes it. So there's this, like, 7 little mini black hole kind of information processor. And it has spin energy, and its spin energy is imparted into the ether, which is sevenfold, which surrounds the monad. And so it's a way in which that monad might form, you know, different, a divine body, a spiritual body, a psychical body, a material body, and be clothed in different bodies. It's all very beautiful. Sometimes I think if the universe isn't like this, it should have been.
Yeah, well, there is that too, yeah.
Physicist says that, eh?
Yeah.
Famous quote.
I was thinking of, like, too, like, the idea of, like, that, you know, that profoundly odd and impossible idea of, like, non-locality in modern physics, and yet, you know, in the mystical teachings, you have people providing explanations of how they develop their consciousness so they experience non-locality and higher states of consciousness. And,
yeah.
and you know, like Yogananda's classic, you know, his description of cosmic consciousness. And but then, too, just like something that's very basic, like this idea, like you, I really like what you said earlier. It's like I think of myself as being a multidimensional being who exists in a multidimensional universe. And I think, like, the essential... essential enigmas in for all of our profound knowledge in modern science, the essential enigmas that still remain are what is the nature of life and what is the nature of consciousness? And we really can't explain those. And in modern thought, we tend to think of everything as being an evolutionary process, and everything is the outcome of this process of increasing complexity from more simple levels, but within the esoteric teaching, it's like Gurdjieff's ideas that we have there's an evolutionary current, but there's an involutionary current, and that we are informed from above through the descent of intelligence and the crystallization of meaning and matter on various levels. And I think that's the critical element that's missing in modern thought, is that we subscribe only to the existence of the evolutionary current, and don't recognize the involutionary current. And that's where the whole breakdown occurs in the science versus religion debate. Is that until people understand that there's every reason to believe in the existence of an involutionary current, then they can't really engage in meaningful discussion about the existence of higher spiritual realities or higher realities at all. And that's something that, I mean, it's such a basic idea, but it opens everything up to an entirely different level of understanding and interpretation, and I think a much more satisfying explanation of the nature of things is, like, because life does, and consciousness, I say, do come from above, like that they come from this higher level, and that you know, we are informed by these higher levels, and it's going on all the time. It's going on in us physically as beings. It's going on in terms of the manifest physical universe. It's being informed by these higher dimensions.
Yeah, all the time. It never wasn't that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything is supernatural.
Yeah,
like people think, oh, you know, anything supernatural occurring around here? Well, your heartbeat. How does the life impulse generated in the heart? It's an unexplainable enigma in modern science that the heart has that inherent beat and generates life in the material body. It's a mystery of science.
And
there's a higher dimensional metaphysics to it. You know, it all makes sense. The idea of consciousness connected to blood flow and the oxygenation of the body, and how air anchors the spirit into the blood through the oxygenation of the body, and how we're ensouled. It all might make sense biophysically, and in terms of, you know, we do have subtle bodies. You know, acupuncture does work. You know, there are chakras, you know. There's evidence for all these things. It's been around for thousands of years, really.
Yeah, and when you really look closely at it, like as powerful a tool as it is, the philosophy of materialism is really limited, because it remain enigmas and mysteries which point to the existence of something beyond the material explanation. And in all varieties of sciences, in the physical science, in the science of physics, in the science of biology, in the science of psychology, all of these things are there and point to the necessity of going beyond the material to explain the material realm. The material realm, to me, it's like so clear from everything I've studied that there is something beyond the material realm. And that, like you say, the evidence for the existence of subtle bodies and it relates to the human anatomy, the higher dimensions related to the actual physically manifest universe. Like, I mean, the evidence is, I would say, overwhelming to go beyond hypothesizing, to actually conceptualizing the existence of ourselves and the universe in terms of these multidimensional levels of reality. I see how people don't recognize that and how limiting it is in terms of people's explanations of everything. The continued integrity of our physical existence when the actual material elements of our bodies are breaking down all the time and being replaced, to me, indicates that there's something beyond the material.
And how many years does it take to replace all the cells in the body?
Well,
I was just reading that the other day. Someone was saying seven.
Six or seven years.
That's right.
And everything has changed.
Every 7 years, your cells are all different cells.
Yeah, your skin cells change every 90 days, I think. All your skin cells.
Yeah, different
replaced.
Cycles.
Everything's occurring. And even within even as human beings, like this idea that we're, you see this all the time, about how everything's happening in our brains, but not everything isn't happening in our brains. That's complete malarkey. That's so stupid. And people say it all the time, too. It's like, I was reading this book on the 60s, and I was reading about Timothy Leary, and at the end when he was dying of prostate cancer, and he was associated with this cryogenics company, and they wanted to decapitate him and preserve his brain so that, and I'm thinking, maybe they should save his heart, I would save his entire body if you want to cryogenically freeze somebody, but that's the ultimate absurd expression of this, all these head cases running around that thinking that everything in our physical existence is really reducible to the brain's activities.
Yeah. That's like Carl Sagan when he in the Broke His Brain
broke
book.
His brain. Yeah,
and he's in France at the museum and he's looking at a jar with a broke his brain in it, pickled. And he's saying to himself, I wonder if broke
somehow
is
still
in
there. Yeah, exactly. It's like you're kidding, right?
Anyway, I noticed we only have 5-10 minutes left, so I thought...
I'm flies when you're discussing the nature of yourself in the universe, yeah.
I got to just try to bring it back a little bit and make some kind of concluding comments. It was really fun today to get back into... exploring such profound kind of mystical teachings, and we covered a lot, the idea of the principles, the laws of 1, 3, and 7, and talked about light and kind of sacred symbols and talked about the idea of the existence of God and how it's connected to the soul hypothesis and the idea of builders we talked about a multidimensional universe and a wide range of ideas. And that's been a part of this show now. We're going into, I guess next year will be our fifth year. Through BBS. And it's been an honor to be part of the BBS radio broadcast this last year, as it has been in the previous years. And I'd like to thank Seth and Don and Doug at BBS. And I wish them the best holiday season and best wishes for the new year. And channels and programs like this program and services like we have from BBS, we're just so lucky that we can connect as a community through such means, and we're allowed such freedom of speech and expression and research. We're so lucky to have that, and you know, we do have a truth movement occurring around the world as people awaken to many of the things we've been misled about politically and internationally, and how the kind of new world order and the problems we're facing with that today. I really think we're at a critical time in human history, and we need an awakening of human consciousness, and we need an awakening of the human heart. We have to end this terrible warfare that it goes on around this planet, and we think it's for democracy and justice, and it never is. It's just always based on lies. It's always based on lies. Humankind, we have to get past the do-re-mi of life on this planet. You know, and people are talking about global government. In a way, I've always agreed with the concept of global government in a way, but we need people who are sane and conscious and have compassion in their hearts as the part who formed the global government. And that's not what we have. We have kind of a group of psychopathic elites who would deceive humankind, will impoverish people, who will subvert the sovereignty of nations and the constitutions of nations. And they're doing this all to us covertly and hiding it through all. It's just an unspeakable corruption and crime throughout our societies. I realized the other day, you know how many letters you have to move to turn Satan into Santa? You only have to move one letter, two spaces, and you can turn Satan into Santa. And I thought, during the Christmas period, boy, people are more interested in Santa on the radio than they are in the Christ story. We've lost something. We've lost the kind of, I don't think that's true. I think Christmas is still such a special season because what it does is it brings people back to our families and gives us a holiday and we have that season of joyousness. And I hope that people have. And that's important. And whether that focuses on Christ's story for you or not, that's okay. It's fine. You know, happy Hanukkah if you're Jewish. I heard the other week someone or some source suggested that the Rockefellers invented Santa, and I wondered if that was true. So I was trying to look up where Santa came from. I know it came from Saint Nick, but somehow it got turned into Santa, and Santa became so important. And my mother turns 90 this month or next month, and she was a very devout Christian woman. And so saintly and selfless in the world, and really embodied what it meant to be a good Christian. Where I'm staying, I look out my window, and there's a big Christian church there. But they didn't even seem to have a service on Christmas Eve night or Christmas Day. It's like, and where is the church? And it's like, wow, we've so lost. Like, where are Christians? You know, how can all these Christians, why aren't the Christians out in the streets protesting these wars and these murders and all these terrible things? You know, how much do we as Christians look after our brothers and sisters? I mean, it's so outrageous. And we think they're religious wars and we're fighting the Muslims. Like, it's all so terrible and based on lies and deceit. You know, there is, in a way, I feel at times, there is no Christian church anymore. Like, there are no Christians. Where are the Christians? You know? And there won't be Christians probably for too much longer. But we'll have Santa anyway. Anyway, so I hope this year, my feeling somehow in 2010, my experience 4 years ago, I had a sense that by 2012, things in the world were really going to be turned around. And I think in the world that we may, you never know, we may see justice in our age. we may ultimately, people may realize who the real terrorists in the world are. They're not who we've been told they were. They're hidden behind the scenes. And once we root out these real terrorists in our societies and take control again of our countries and seize their assets and pay off the debts of nations around the world, and by 2012 reduce the world debts to all countries around the world to zero, and have a zero point in 2012, and then have a new world and bring in all those things, those teachings and new science that have been suppressed and that these people have held back the evolution of humankind upon this planet. And I think next year, I think we're going to start seeing this all unwind on them. I think too many people have gotten the case. Too many people are waking up and seeing the extent of the corruption within our societies. It all goes back to the lies of 9/11 and the lies of all the other things that are being done to our countries and to citizens. It's really, as you wake up, it in a way, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. You know, why can't we just have a sane human race? You know, have a world government, but of conscious people with love in their hearts, you know, who honor and respect the peoples of the world. You know, we can't impoverish all the people of the world so that these world elites can amass unspeakable wealth that they have in their greed and their lust for power. It's so insane. Why did we have to have such an insane world? We, you know, we got to deal with these insane people who have taken over our countries. These people are criminally insane. You know, they have plans to commit genocide against people. Like, you know, these are crimes they're committing. You know, their crimes are so obvious. Everybody knows the game is up. These people need to be dealt with somehow in our countries. And we'll send our best wishes to all the police out there and to the military forces. I hope you men and women at some point honor your oaths to your countries and to human justice and liberty. Don't serve these Santa Claus or Satan with his little whatever. Okay, we got to take our countries back. And I think the tide is going to turn. I think these people are going to end up being imprisoned for their crimes. And it'll all come out, and there might be a rapture around the world when all the truths are revealed and these people learn who these people have been and the things they've done to us over the generations. And then we will have a new world, a new age on this planet, because there's so much abundance, and if we brought forth all the new technologies and ideas, we'd transform the Earth. And our life on planet Earth, and I believe open up travel through the solar system and beyond to human beings, even through our own psychical powers. I think these things are all possible and conceivable. So anyway, I'd like to thank BBS Radio. This is the end of the 29. I'd like to thank those Canadian activists who have been guests on my show through the last year. I'd like to thank James Moffat. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Any final words, anything you'd like to say?
No.
Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll carry on. Best wishes, Jim. Happy New Year.
Yeah, I would like to say thanks to Doug and Don and to everybody at BBS Radio for allowing us to have this program for the last 4-plus years. It's an honor and a privilege to be afforded this platform, and we really appreciate your network and all your efforts. Thanks very much.
Okay. So, and thank listeners for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Remember yourself. Keep heart. 2010, I think we're going to begin to see this coming undone and see some pretty dramatic changes in our society. Okay. Thank you all. Goodbye.
Thanks a lot.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the the sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life, Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. They took away our land, they put us on the run, locked us on this reservation, changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. Chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride, armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride.